and one who is still wrapping up in another committee. So we want to get started. And now I want to warn you, we're going to be out here at 5, so you can't talk for more than an hour and 45 minutes, okay?
I've been here since 7:30.
Oh, good.
Okay. I have a hand there. You guys have your hand out.
Good. Here we go. Well, this is what we're going to talk about today.
Just in time. Look at that.
Yeah.
Just in time delivery. It's a business concept.
No, we did have some. You may have heard about what we had Karen Whitaker and Drew Solberg, and they did their part. Now we're moving into your part, which is really the important part. So.
Yeah, we work.
So don't disappoint us, please.
We won't. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. My name's Craig Hofstetler, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Primary Care Association. And to my right is Doug Briggs, the Legislative Affairs Coordinator for my organization. And to my left is Steve Manella, which I know you know him from the Lane County, one of our newer federally qualified health centers in the state.
Now, I want to just stop for a minute, and I want Senator Mona Sanderson to talk about her committee also. We are both chairs of health committees. Hers is a health policy committee. This is the human services committee. Mm-hmm. The lines are kind of blurred, but we are going to work together on everything. I'm on her committee. She's on my committee. So you're talking to the two chairs of the two committees. So.
Great.
So go for it.
Okay. Well, thank you. So the first slide, just briefly about my organization so you know who we are. We're an association of safety net clinics and various public and private nonprofit organizations, and we're working towards improving access to healthcare services for vulnerable populations across Oregon. But having said that, our primary members are federally qualified health centers. We do work with Karen Whitaker and others because we have a lot of common issues and sometimes some of the same clinics as well. They can convert from a rural health clinic to a federally qualified health center in rural and frontier areas as well. And my organization specifically provides advocacy at the state and national level for our clinics and the patients they serve, and also provides operational strategic planning, et cetera, that type of assistance for them to strengthen the clinic. So on the next slide, to briefly step back, federally qualified health centers have been running for about 40 years now. And they grew out of the war on poverty movement in the 60s. And the idea there was to set up a health center in a vulnerable area and employ people from that area, provide a job source, and have a healthier workforce as well. So that was kind of what it grew out of. It's a partnership between federal, state, local, and private entities in a local community. And if one of those entities has less resources, for example, the Medicaid, then we got to scramble to find ways to make up our whole budget. So that combination is very important. The next slide. What I'm going to do in this presentation, and this is just, I won't go into the semantics of it, I'll spare you that, but community health centers and federally qualified health centers over the years have been used interchangeably. So for the purpose of this presentation, federally qualified health centers means community health centers. The basic characteristics of these federally qualified health centers is they're located in high-need areas, and these are federally designated medically underserved population areas or medically underserved areas. They provide comprehensive primary care, and we've used enabling services, and folks told us don't use that. But what we mean are services that help the patient get to the clinic. It could be transportation, get to the right form of care. It can be case management, taking them to specialists, to hospitals, et cetera, back to the clinic and making sure they're really getting the right level of care depending on what their condition is. So that's the piece that we think really helps save money downstream. We're open to all residents regardless of ability to pay, and that means everybody, uninsured, Medicaid, private insurance, Medicare, et cetera. And a key piece of this is we're governed by a community-based board of directors, and what we mean by that is over 50% of our boards have to be patients of the clinics that we serve. And also the other portion can be community leaders. It can be judges. It can be folks from hospitals, et cetera, based on whatever the needs of the community are or whatever the needs of the health center is. What this does is ensure local flexibility and accountability, because you really can't go in a direction that doesn't serve your patients well if your patients are governing you, and the community is making sure that you're spending the resources wisely. We're held to strict performance and accountability measures, and I'll talk more about that later. On the next slide, still staying with the national, and I'll break it down to the Oregon-specific numbers, is that we serve nationally more than 3,600 urban and rural communities in every state and territory. We typically serve low-income urban or resource-poor rural and frontier communities, and we provide quality primary care, and by primary care we're including medical, dental, and mental health in that package. We have to provide that. And we're accessible to vulnerable populations, and that's a key point of our whole program. One more slide on national, and I'll break it down to our state level. The health centers that we serve, the health centers across the country serve 1 of 8 uninsured and 1 of 9 Medicaid beneficiaries. So it gives you a size of a feeling of our scope. We serve 10 million people of color and 1 in 10 rural residents. We serve 1 in 5 low-income children. And you can see the other statistics on there, but I do want to draw your attention to the last one, which is 90% of our health center patients are at or below 200% of federal poverty level. So that's the key populations that we target. On the next slide, this is where we get to the Oregon figures. We have 23 federally qualified health centers in Oregon with over 125 sites, and these are medical, dental, or mental health sites across Oregon. In 2003, we collect data by the calendar year, and so we're going to get 2004 figures in the next couple of months. But we served 180,000 Oregonians, so that's our scope, and provided over 800,000 medical, dental, and mental health visits in that year. And combined, we served 74,000 uninsured and 72,000 Medicaid patients, which equals over 80% of the patients that we serve. And you can see we serve 1 in 8 uninsured Oregonians, so that's similar to the national model, but we serve 1 in 5 Medicaid beneficiaries, and so that's more than the national statistics.
Excuse me. Are you also dealing now with people who've lost their Oregon health plan? I mean, I'm sure.
We certainly do, and I'll talk a little bit more about what that means in our budget, but certainly when they go from Oregon health plan standard to uninsured, they stay in our clinics, and that really changes our patient mix.
Yeah.
So. And the last one there is again, we're above the national average of 90%. Almost 95% of our health center patients are at or below 200% of federal poverty level in Oregon. So this is the piece that you are starting to get into, which is the federally qualified health center budget. The one myth I want to dispel that's out there is folks relate federally qualified to federally funded, which is couldn't be any further from the truth. In fact, our budget is 15% comes from the Bureau of Primary Health Care, which is positive. It's to specifically serve the uninsured. But we have 40% of our patients are uninsured, so you add those two together. Obviously, we aren't covering our costs. So how do we make ends meet? Well, the rest of our budget, we rely 43% on Medicaid, and we're seeing over the years how that's decreasing as the Oregon Health Plan standard goes down. 3% from Medicare, 3% from other public, so that can be the Family Planning Expansion Project or other public sources of funding. 3% from private insurance companies, 6% are self-pay. So those are the uninsured that I talked about before. We're required to charge a sliding fee scale that's set by the community-based board of directors. So it slides from 100% of cost, 200% of federal poverty level or above, down to if you're less than 100% of federal poverty level, it's a nominal rate, $15, $20, whatever the board sets.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Huber-Kovian.
Craig, on the private pay to commercial insurance, kind of curious how that might work in terms of, for example, do any state employees, are they able to even get care at a very qualified health center, or are there things in terms of like provider panels that centers aren't able to be part of so they don't get certain insured?
Yeah, the answer to that ranges by community. Some of our health centers are successful in getting on any of the provider panels, so the answer would be yes, they'd have access to the federally qualified health centers. In other communities, it may be more difficult depending on what panel you're looking at getting on. But certainly our health centers do try to get on panels to serve medical, dental, and mental health visits. So does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. And then, so when we do the sliding fee scale, 6% of our budget comes from that. So it is a significant source. And what we found is patients take pride in paying for their health care. I mean, that's the bottom line. We don't have it as a barrier to them receiving care. So if they can only afford $5 a month, that's what we collect until we collect the whole cost of the visit. So our accounts payable isn't always a great number. The last statistic there is important. 27% of our budget comes from other grants. It can be federal, state, local, fundraising from private foundation, individual donors, et cetera, so we can make up that gap.
Now, I'm give me an idea of which private foundations and so on.
Okay.
If you...
It ranges. On the federal side, we have a project going amongst a lot of our health centers to get electronic medical records installed, and so we rely on some Bureau of Primary Health Care money. There's other federal foundations that we've looked at, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, et cetera, to help promote these types of services. Locally, though, the Meyer Memorial Trust provides some funding for our clinics, and the funding is interesting. A lot of times operations, you can get some operations funding, but it's short term because folks don't like to fund operations on an ongoing basis. The other thing that we really try to fundraise for is bricks and mortar in the building, because that's not included in our cost-based reimbursement portfolio. The Northwest Health Foundation, the Ford Foundation, Ford Family Foundation, others really help out our health center.
I guess what I'm trying to get a handle on is which foundations are involved currently and which are out there that could be involved. I know they're, it depends on the project and so on. And
yeah.
I know the Ford Family Foundation, they were at a meeting, a caucus meeting that we had, a joint Democratic Senate retreat. And I know they have the big funds, and then they have these small community grants. They call them community building grants, where they go out into the rural communities and they try to build an effort. And it could be in health, it could be in other areas. And I'm trying to look at how to tap into.
Mm-hmm.
So I would appreciate knowing some of if you could get some of the information about which agencies are currently involved, which foundations.
Okay, sure.
It would be helpful to know where your private friends are coming from.
Okay, and Chair Moore said I'd love to have one of our clinics answer that question.
Yeah, I can speak to, community health centers. Blaine County is a fairly new federally qualified health center. We've been in business for a little bit over a year, but we have partnership with the local hospitals and the local school districts and local government, and then we have some partnerships and some things in the hopper with foundations. But I think one of the opportunities here is that there are things that we do as individual clinics with foundations, there are things that we do as an association with foundations, and there could be things that we could do statewide with other foundations, those things range in opportunity.
Okay. What I'm looking for, and I would really appreciate it if you could get some information to our committee administrator, Rick, about some of the foundations that you're working with, and I would like to know what the possibilities are for. I would like to become involved in getting some foundations involved in building a trust fund and getting involved in some of the clinics. Because I know that foundations have a lot of different things that they're doing. There may be foundations that are not helping at the time, but could.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm interested in. But I'm also interested in what you said about the hospitals, because it seems like when I ask you at ART when I visited the clinic, I said, how are you doing with the hospital that's two blocks away? And you said, well, not as well as the one that's across the river.
Peace
Health is pretty well. McKinsey Willamette is not doing as well, but they're the ones who are next door.
Yeah.
So it seems like hospitals and anyone who could help lower their costs by having you perform work that they would otherwise have to deal with in their emergency room or charity cases and so on.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're, well.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I mean, we do have local efforts, as Steve was saying, Chair Moore said, and we are looking at strategies. We have a new director of development, or fairly new, on the Oregon Primary Care Association. It's kind of looking at the overall, what's the landscape look like locally and nationally, or the things that we can get together on, or, you know, providing information out to health centers on funding that's available. So, but there's always ways to creatively get to the door, so we appreciate that interest. So
I'd like to, I guess, be in touch with that person.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
In other words, if they're new and they're strategizing on how to, you know, what to do, I'd like to know that. I'd like to, you know, understand what they're doing, and I'd like to be able to work with them to do whatever I can to help.
Okay, great. That's fantastic. On the next slide, what I've given you is encounters or visits that occur at our health centers in the breakdown. So about 40% are uninsured, 43% Medicaid. So that is a good revenue source for us. We almost recoup our costs on Medicaid, whereas we're fundraising a lot for uninsured costs. And Medicare is about 5% of our encounters, other publics 3%, and private insurance is 9%. One thing that you may notice is we have 9% of our visits come from the private market, but only 3% of our revenue. It may look like we're losing a lot of money, but really we found that our private insurance visits cost less money to serve their needs, so it's not as big of a loss that it looks like. So. The next slide, and slide 10, the federally qualified health center benefits. The primary benefits and the reasons communities come together and go through the process of becoming a federally qualified health center is that, you know, we talked about the President and Congress commitment to doubling the number of patients seen in health centers from 2002 to 2006. In Oregon, we've added 10 new sites. We've grown to 23 federally qualified health centers. We've added 10 satellite sites of existing health centers. We've had 6 medical expansions, 10 dental site expansions, 2 mental health expansions, and a pharmacy integration project. So we've done quite well, and we're going to continue to apply. So that's another source that we're looking at for
Governor. Well, that's the good news for Congress. The bad news is they're going to cut Medicare and Medicaid.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right on our page. So, you know, the other benefit that we have is we have access to 340B drug pricing, so we can get cheaper pharmaceuticals for our patient, and we have Pfizer sharing the care program, which is free pharmaceuticals for uninsured. And we have the third bullet point there is access to Federal Tort Claims Act coverage, which is essentially medical malpractice insurance that's free. It doesn't cover everything, but they're working on it, so we do have wraparound insurance, but it certainly does save money. And then the last thing is we have enhanced Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement. So why is there so much federal support, and why are we working with our state and local partners to build support here? We are cost efficient. That's one main reason folks support us. Another one we've already talked about, we serve the vulnerable population, so we're providing care where it's needed most. But according to Medicaid managed care data, patients seen at our federally qualified health centers cost about $142 per member per month. That's hospital visits, emergency room visits, pharmaceuticals, primary care. And patients seen elsewhere cost about $205 per member per month, so it's a 30% savings in our health centers. We believe because it's all those services in terms of getting them to the right level of care, providing culturally competent care, those types of things really pay dividends downstream.
Yeah. Let me just ask a quick question about pharmaceuticals. What kind of cost savings, or what's the pharmaceutical?
The pharmaceutical savings in the next bullet point at the very in the third line there is the reduce of pharmaceutical cost by about 41%. What we find is, for example, in one of our health centers, the average patient comes in with 8 pharmaceuticals, so they've been prescribed all types of things. Since they really can't afford, once they become uninsured, to continue to pay for all those pharmaceuticals, the physician works with what's the best pharmaceutical regimen this patient should be on, so cuts some of them out. We learn how to extend resources and find free pharmaceuticals. There's other ways that we can provide and save money in the pharmaceutical area.
Okay, so there is not a special uninsured category for pharmaceuticals. It's just that you, they, through your clinic, through various mechanisms, you can save the money, but there's no... Okay. We're trying to... We do have a drug, bulk purchasing drug bill that only applies to 55 and older at 185% of poverty, and we would like to get rid of the age and the poverty requirement to be able to put the uninsured under that umbrella. It is not up and running yet. I mean, it's we do have a PDM. Mm-hmm. And we do have, well, the administrator, Mitzi Dolan, under Bruce Goldberg, is running the program, and it's, we're working at it, but we're trying to expand it, whether or not we are going to be able to, and how much money we're going to be saved, for sure we don't know, because the governor is trying to do imports, mm-hmm. for one, and we're looking at other ways of bringing the cost down, but we're not there yet.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Go, Rick. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. And, okay, you might put in perspective, too, most all the drugs are purchased under the 340B program, and you describe, when we've heard this, and I've heard it four or five times, I always need a refresher, how that kind of works generally and where that kind of price falls. For example, what we pay right now for Medicaid drugs and where, what we get for 340B generally.
Okay. Well, and I may turn it over. Steve's looking at this program right now. I'll give you the general a piece of it, and turn it over to Steve. But basically, there's certain drugs that we can buy through the 340B program, and they have the maximum amount that pharmacies can charge us for those drugs. So we can negotiate below it, but there is a maximum amount they can charge. And so I want Steve to talk about, if you know, the savings.
For the 340B program on medications, it runs between a 40% to 60% savings.
Oh.
The way it works is that the federal government has a contract with pharmaceutical companies, and they determine those prices on a quarterly basis, and they're required to provide medications at below wholesale cost to federally qualified health centers to serve federally qualified health center patients, and that's the key, is how we that we've been looking at, is how we broaden the benefit to who is a patient of the federally qualified health center in order to expand the use of that program. And some other states have looked at that as well on a statewide basis to see what they could do with that.
Now, oh, I'm sorry. Did you? No, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Chair. Just to clarify then, those prices are actually below what we pay our Medicaid or Oregon Health Plan.
Yeah, I believe, I'm not certain, but I've heard that Medicaid is like wholesale plus 15%, and we're at 40 to 60% below wholesale, so there's a difference there.
How does it work? If a person comes in, you write a prescription, they take it to the drugstore, is there a rebate or what?
The way it works, it can work in a number of ways. Some health centers have an in-house dispensary. Some have an in-house pharmacy program.
Oh.
Others have contracts with the commercial pharmacy where a patient can go and fill the pharmacy like they would with any other health plan. So.
Okay, so it would be they would make contracts with specific individual pharmacies rather than...
Well, the requirement is you can only have one pharmacy contract. So in effect, what you do is you contract with a pharmacy, either a retail or you can do by mail, but with a pharmacy.
In other words, the patients have to go to that particular pharmacy to get that particular discount.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
Okay. I was not aware of that program.
Yeah, but you can. What you can do is if you're an FQHC and you have multiple sites, like in Multnomah County, where they have a number of different clinics and a pharmacy at each, you can have a pharmacy at each site. Or if you contract for pharmacy, you can have a pharmacy. You can work with the same pharmacy at different locations with a commercial vendor.
Okay. Good.
The other components of those savings are the reduced hospitalizations and ER visits. We had a a nice laboratory, I guess, for lack of a better term, in Prineville, in the center of Oregon. We opened a new health center there a few years ago. And the hospital, the only hospital in that town, was seeing an increase on average over a four-year period of 8% every year was an increase in their ER visits. And a lot of these visits were uninsured. And when we set up Ochoco Community Health Center, there was an instant decrease the next year in the number of visits they saw in their emergency room. So that really showed, you know, there is a correlation between setting up one of these health centers and keeping them out of the emergency room, which is expensive. So on the next thing, the other reason we get a lot of support is we do provide a high quality of care. I've been told not to use acronyms, so I'll tell you what this acronym is. We undergo a Joint Commission on Accreditation for Healthcare Organizations. That's a certification. It's like the Good Housekeeping seal of approval, both for hospitals and ambulatory care facilities like ours. Over 30% of our facilities have gone through this nationwide. On the clinic side, only 3% have JCO certification. If they haven't gone through that, they go through a federal performance review that takes an intensive look at different things like clinic operations, the clinical quality, finance, and governance to make sure that the patients that are on our board are actually involved in the decision-making process. So we're held to some strict standards. The other thing that we do is we target chronic conditions, and we do that because it's our mission, but whether we like to or not, we have to do it because it's a federal mandate. We target asthma, diabetes, hypertension, et cetera, and we really get those patients to the right level of care. So I just put in one statistic there that through an asthma collaborative, we decreased from 14 to 2% those that reported to the emergency room within the last 2 weeks. So it really starts helping saving downstream costs, and it's an effective way of really managing care and health status.
Now, how about the diabetes?
Diabetes, we can get you some information on. We do have various studies, no local studies.
Well, obesity and diabetes, yeah, and all those things go together, and there's more of that now. And
yeah. Yeah, and we do focus on those things. Obesity, not yet, but they are looking at that nationally to get collaboratives set up around obesity and other things that are coming around. But it's certainly it's a quality way of running your program. So even if you have just a collaborative in asthma or diabetes, you roll it out to other parts of your organization. On the next slide, it shows that these federally qualified health centers are an economic engine in the communities, especially in the rural and frontier communities, because sometimes they're the largest employer, you know, maybe even the only employer in town. It's a major source of jobs nationally, occurring 78,000 plus jobs. Here in Oregon, these federally qualified health centers are responsible for 3,400 jobs. We create over $258 million in economic output. And they really serve as critical anchors, and again, especially in the rural and frontier areas, and helping attract and retain other businesses by having a healthcare source there. So employees have to drive 30, 40, 50. You've heard the statistics from Karen Whitaker and others.
Yeah.
So on the next slide, why is state and local support needed? We're still in the middle of this, getting towards the later stages of this growth initiative. We need to take advantage of it. But the key to a federally qualified health center's viability is that combination of federal, state, local, and private funds. So that's been our challenge over the past couple of years. And as Medicaid cuts continue, that federally qualified health center viability is an issue, something that really strains our resources. Obviously, through the state budget, we haven't had line items for federally qualified health centers. We know there's not much new revenue out there. So that's another thing that we're dealing with. How do we make ends meet? And this fundraising suggestion you came up with earlier, Chair Morissette, is certainly something worth pursuing and letting you know about, because that's a source.
So when was the last time you had line items from the state?
That was three sessions ago. I'm looking for... It was before my time. So, Joy, do you remember the last time we had a line item for Safety Net Clinics? Was that three sessions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She can identify herself.
Okay. I'm sorry, but you're going to have to come up here and identify yourself and tell us that over again. Rules.
For the record, my name is Joy Suarez, and the answer to your question is there was a line item for the safety net in the 2001-03 biennium. Okay. However, after the five special sessions and the next e-board after that, the funding was not allocated.
And how large was the line? I mean, what percentage of your income depended on the state?
So the percent, actually what it broke down to, when we had about 72 different organizations, so it was rural health clinics, federally qualified health centers, et cetera, and each one got about, I think, between $12,000 and $14,000 a piece. So the smallest budget we have in a federally qualified health center is $1 million. So it wasn't a big piece of our budget.
Well, then my next question is, what happened during the good years? I mean, were there times when the state was
I think what changed was that the safety net groups, which started a coalition, and so they started asking for money on behalf of all the safety net clinics, whereas before they had gone individually. Rural health went individually to the legislature, so did school-based health centers as well as federally qualified health centers. So they formed a coalition a couple years ago, realizing that they have a lot of common needs between them, and came forward and asked money under that particular name. So that was why it was the first time that it was allocated to them under the Healthcare Safety Net Coalition. And I believe it started out at $13 million, then down to $7 million, and then it went to $1.2 million, and then it ended up $1.2 million, and then it was cut after that.
Okay, so it was never really a large amount. And
correct.
Some individual groups probably did fairly well, or there was probably some competition among groups for the funding.
Yeah, there's always competition.
There's always competition, and going together, then, you know, some lost and some gained, and then everybody lost.
Yeah, everybody did lose. And, you know, especially after that session, no money was allocated, and then all the cuts to OHP happened.
And I guess what I'm getting to are, what are the compelling needs of your organization for state funding? I mean, can you get along without state funding? And if you can, why are you here?
Right. No. No. That's a good question, Chair Morissette. Basically, what we've seen across our state, as Oregon Health Plan Standard in particular has started making cuts, is that we've had some clinic closures.
I understand.
And we've had, if it's not a clinic closure, it's a cut back in services. So a dental clinic may close or scale back. You know, there's some other things that we provide to really provide comprehensive primary care that we need to scale back on. And so that's how you survive if you're going to stay open, but it's not the best for the patient. It doesn't really.
Then I think that you have to make a case for a compelling need to take care of the people who are being cut from the health plan. It's an extremely worthy cause, and the state has to participate. And I think a lot of granting organizations, you know, expect state participation. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, I can see them saying, well, if the state doesn't think it's important, why should we?
Right.
So how about matching funds? Do some require state matching funds?
Do some foundations require? They certainly require matching funds.
Matching.
Yeah.
So you can get it from various places.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the Oregon Health Plan is the bread and butter for these safety net clinics.
Yeah.
And when your best payer is actually the Oregon Health Plan, you seriously have some questions with regards to your sustainability, especially with the increase of the uninsured.
Okay. So if we put adequate money into the Oregon Health Plan, that obviously would filter down to you, because you service a lot of the people in the plan, and if the people who drop out of the plan continue to go, that, you know, that makes it difficult. So it's a compounded kind of
correct
cut. So,
and both are needed to help with the uninsured as well as Oregon Health Plan.
I understand. Okay, thank you very much.
And again, to look at the federal grants that we get from the Bureau of Primary Health Care, they are a block grant. So as the uninsured increases, whether we expand to get more uninsured, or whether we get more insured by Medicaid dropping, or whatever the reason is, our grant stays the same. And these just pay a portion of the cost of the uninsured to start with. So really, the more uninsured we continue to see, the more fundraising we need to do. So that's why your question earlier, Chair Morris, that is very important. So the last slide we had is coming up with some solutions, and we know it's going to be a really tough session. And the first thing that I have up there is to reinstate the voter-approved tobacco tax. We're working with a broad-based group of folks to do that. And to target it for different areas, in particular, low-income health and tobacco prevention, obviously, are two areas that would be well used with the tobacco tax. Also, we're working with some groups to take a look at targeting, you know, the most bang for your buck, you know, children. Certainly, if you provide good primary care and other services to children, you really see dividends in the long run. Same with pregnant women and those with chronic conditions, asthma, diabetes, et cetera, that I talked about before. And to provide some funding for core safety net clinics that could close. And you know, these could be rural health clinics, which aren't my primary members, but if there's a lack of funding in this next session, that some of them could close, and I'm sure Karen Whitaker talked about that. And school-based health centers are certainly important, and there's some others.
Okay. Now, I know that there is at least one bill to reinstate the tobacco tax that we used to have that was cut. I think that was a 10-cent tax. Now, are you aware of a bill that is out there?
We certainly are, and we're working with
Well,
okay, go ahead.
What is there a dedication attached to it?
Right now, my understanding is there isn't, and there's a group working together to get on the same page, Chair Moore said, about where the funding should go and what are the principles of the funding and things like that, because the more folks that are on the same page, I think the better.
Well, the more folks that are on the same page, the harder it's going to be to dedicate the funding to you, in a sense. Okay, I guess...
Depends on what page they're on.
What page, right?
Yeah.
Well... That's interesting, and I guess there is an effort to put into place an alcohol recovery fee, which is a euphemism for beer tax. But what we've been very careful to do is designate where the money is going to go, and so we have the advocates who are working hard together. Now, if all of the advocates are working hard to pass this cigarette tax, and you're part of that, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a group of people who each see that as their source of funding, then who knows?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs, and I just wanted to comment on that briefly. We have spent several months trying to build a broad-based coalition, including both the private sector, the public sector, and our centers. And our hope is that we'll be able to get a significant number of people to come back into this room in a month or so and commit to supporting proposal like
sure.
You're talking about. We have seen the other bill that's out there. I haven't taken a very close look at it, but if I recall, it's a general allocation to the Oregon Health Program, and we haven't taken a detailed look at it, but we'll be coming back to you at some point very soon.
Well, personally, I support that effort for your purposes, and I would hope that you could, you know, get coalesce around that, because it is, well, I support that effort. So.
Mr. Chairman, if I could also point out, one of the elements here in our proposals to try to take advantage of drawing down the maximum federal match as well. So it doesn't That's make true. An awful lot of sense to leave federal money on
okay.
the table when you might have an opportunity
Absolutely.
Through these programs.
So
too.
That money goes into the Oregon Health Plan to get the federal match, and then there will be 60-40 grand, you know, coming to the state of that, and then they can disperse it. Okay, that makes sense. So rather than going directly to your group, that would go into the Oregon Health Plan for the match, and then the distribution would be up for grabs.
That's certainly the thing that we're talking about, I think.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment on this. I think that one of the things that we're faced with is with the cutback in the standard program is that, you know, the way in which people have been dropped from coverage doesn't necessarily relate to their health conditions, and I think a key aspect of this proposal is to look at something that would provide for providing services to people with chronic
conditions, and so I think a partnership with the safety net clinics, you know, could be a good alternative, you know, as well as looking at the support for the overall plan, and there is precedence for this.
Good.
Fine. Amen.
No, anytime, you know, feel free to jump in.
Okay. The next thing, we certainly participate in the Oregon Health Policy Commission, which we think is doing a lot of good work and continues to, so they have recommendations about the entire healthcare system. So that's a good source of some solutions. And then there's the Oregon Healthcare Safety Net Policy Team, which just recently released a report and kind of came up with recommendations that we were one of the participants on as well. And obviously that's looking at the safety net. So those are a couple of areas for solutions. And then finally, to support developing and implementing local healthcare solutions. I mean, what we found through our federally qualified health center model is when different folks from the community come together and come up with a solution that's tailored to that community, it really works. And so the challenge is, and this is what the Oregon Health Policy Commission is looking at and others, is how do you then free up barriers that are there for other communities to do the same thing? And it could be a federally qualified health center. It could be a network between specialists and hospitals and others for low-income health care. But the point is that the local solution, they can come up with some pretty creative things, but there's also some barriers into implementing those types of things.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just make a quick point on that. We were in Prineville about a month ago with Senator Ben Westland, and we had a number of the board members from the Ochocoke Center who were there with us for lunch, and it was very impressive to see the list of people on the board, obviously patients of the center, but members of the Chamber of Commerce, the banking community, the hospital, the county commission, the Children and Families Commission, and they had gone through a strategic plan and a planning process to bring the whole community together in support of the center. And that really is a foundation of making sure that an FQHC can work in a community. You don't just plop a center down and open the doors and say, we're going to go into business today. It's the culmination of a long period of time, and really getting the community involved as a whole has made these very successful.
Now, that's one of the areas that the Ford Family Foundation works in. They will go into a community and try to get a group of people together to build the program from the ground up and create the community leaders or get the community leaders involved. And it could be a health program or it could be something else. Now, I consider this as an economic development tool as well, because we're trying to attract businesses to settle in rural areas, and it's very important that they have good medical care. So it's
sure.
It's more than so. The community building is important for that very reason, to get the bankers involved as well.
Right. Sure.
Question. Yes. Thank you, Chair. The centers receive for Medicaid cost-based reimbursement through.
It's a little less than cost-based reimbursement. To really be explicit about that, for 2001, this new rate, the prospective payment system rate, was based on our average in 99 and 2000 costs. So that's our 2001 base. And then every year, it's adjusted by what's called the Medicare Economic Index, which increases between 2 to 3% a year. So it really doesn't keep up with our costs. But it's close. I mean, it's good, but it's not complete cost.
I'll follow up on that.
Yes.
Could you explain then briefly how the centers, if they do either get money that flows through the state, the agency, do the monies, do you actually have to claim dollars through medical assistance program? And is there paperwork reporting then that has to kind of go through the state agency?
There is. They have to be registered with the state as a federally qualified health center and show that their sites have been designated under this term. And if it's a non-managed care or fee-for-service patient, then the bill goes straight to the state. If it's a Medicaid managed care patient, the bill goes to the Medicaid managed care organization, and the difference between the rate is made up by the state in what's called a wraparound.
Another question? Yes. Is that a fairly timely payment they make then?
It is. It takes about 9 to 12 months to collect that wraparound, and so what that does is cause cash flow issues that folks in Lane County are dealing with right now.
Oh.
infamous wraparound.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah. Regarding that, do all FQHCs, and I'm sorry I'm using the enactment, federally qualified health
See, I haven't done that yet. I'm pretty proud of myself.
And I still could never say JCO. I could never remember the joint, whatever it is. But do all of the federally qualified health centers have electronic billing or not?
No. Well, almost all. As Senator Emanuel Anderson, what we've done is we've worked to get electronic billing because that speeds up the process, and the majority of them do. But some of our new health centers that are just coming online, obviously, they're working towards that. So for the most part, yes. But we're working with some practice management software to speed that up and to make sure that not only are they doing it, but they're not making mistakes, which can cause other delays.
Right.
So.
A follow-up. Yeah. Yeah, I had just heard that, you know, once you get on electronic billing, it's the difference of 6 days having receiving payment versus several weeks or several months.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
No,
Senator Anderson, one thing that has delayed it is when we apply for the wraparound, we do it in a batch, and that's how the system has been set up. And what we have is what's called dual eligibles in our system, so it can be a Medicare and a Medicaid patient. And so we have to submit to Medicare first, and then if it's a Medicaid managed care patient for the rest of it, then we got to submit it to the Medicaid managed care organization. And then once that's, resolved, then we submit it to the state. So that's part of the delay mechanism that we've worked with. And it's happening in other states as well. We've been working with the state. They've been a good partner to actually cut that back a little bit. And we continue working with OMAP on that.
Regarding that, we won't have dual eligibles after this new Medicare bill coming through. Is that correct? Or will there still be some type of dual eligibles?
I believe there will be some type of dual eligibles.
For pharmaceuticals, there will not be.
Right. But for pharmaceuticals,
that would be it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be it. Yeah.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yes. What will become of those dual eligible populations that are right now in the centers? Do they remain with the centers? Do they go to a private plan? The Part D requires they enroll in a private plan.
It depends on the options available to them. What we've been doing through our various organizations is the Medicare Modernization Act is a very confusing and complex act, and Part D is something that health centers have been looking at, is how do we expand or how do we tweak our pharmacy program if we have one in order to maximize the benefits to the patient. So if they can do that, yeah, then they will stay within the health center, but if not, you're right, they could be looking elsewhere to be getting their prescriptions filled.
Now, Steve, you haven't introduced yourself yet.
Yeah,
have a question for you.
Yes, I'm Steve Minella, and I'm the Director of Community Health Centers of Lane County.
Okay. Now, you explained to me, I think, when I visited, the wraparound.
Yes.
Yeah, could you refresh my memory on
the
payment?
Basically, the way it works is that we work through managed care through LIPA in Lane County for Medicaid eligible.
An acronym.
And it's the Lane Individual Practice Association that we're working with. And we submit to them our charges, and then they pay us, typically 40-50% of charge. And then what we do is on a quarterly basis, we put together a spreadsheet after the managed care company turns in their quarterly report to the state OMAP office. And after receiving the quarterly report, then OMAP then turns around the reimbursement to us. And that along with the dual eligibility that Craig mentioned is what delays the payment, which has been particularly difficult for establishing a new health center for cash flow when you have accounts receivables that are out for a number of months. So it's something that we have worked with the state on to try to help us with that a bit.
Have you? Okay. Now, I think that was something that we had talked about that I was going to look into in terms of the wraparound, the billing and LIPA in the state and so on. And that has not been resolved, right?
Well, it hasn't. No.
Okay, that's something. Okay, so the timeliness of the payment is important, that you get half of it relatively soon, and then you have to wait for months to get the rest of it?
Yeah, I think what Senator Anderson, her example is when we have an open card patient through OMAP on electronic billing, the kind of turnaround time we have on the payment, we can get payment within 3 days.
Yeah.
If we have somebody who goes through managed care, then we have to wait the number of months to receive the wraparound payment. So it's just the difference between navigating the managed care system versus directly billing OMAP.
Okay. Now, just to be sure I understand this, have you started on a process to change that?
I think what I can say is we negotiated something specifically for our health center that is allowing us to turn in data to them on a monthly basis, and we're still going to have to wait about 7 months for our reimbursement. And what Craig could speak to is this is a issue I think the association has discussed over time with the state, and so he may have more background historically on what's happened around this.
Well, I think that's unacceptable to wait 7 months for your payment.
Okay. Well, thank you for your questions, Mr. Chairman. And I said I'd try to keep it short, and that is my last slide. The last slide on here is really contact information, so any further questions you have, we do have some notes on things you want us to follow up on, and we certainly will do that. But anything else that comes up, we do want to be a resource for you and your committee members.
One other question to Steve is the hang-up with LIPA or with OMAP? I mean, is it or both?
Well, I wouldn't call it a hang-up per se, but it is an issue on billing through OMAP because we get paid by the Lane Independent Practitioners Association. They pay us very promptly. So the
but they pay you half?
Well, what they do is that managed care typically pays based upon a capitation or a fee for service,
yeah,
that's a percentage of what the charge. And then what happens is that we get this prospective payment that Craig mentioned that's a little bit less than cost, and we get that wraparound payment then through OMAP later on.
Ruby, are you trying to chime in?
Yeah.
Why do you sit way back there? You should be sitting up in front if you're going to be making faces.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ruby Houghton. I'm the Public Affairs Director for CARE Oregon, mm-hmm. One of the aforementioned managed care plans. Relative to the wraparound payment for the safety net clinics, federally qualified health centers in particular, that we're discussing today, that is a discussion that we have had with OMAP in trying to seek prompter payment. And so if, with your indulgence, what we would like to do is work with you,
yeah,
to put together a bill to pursue prompt payment. This is not just an Oregon problem. It is a national problem. And I think that there are some things that we can do, working together with Craig and his association and with others in seeing if we can't get a prompter payment situation going as it relates to the wraparound payment.
Okay. But the bill would address the state part of it. Now, you said...
Yes, it would. Now, we have to keep in mind that there's a portion of this that is federal.
Yeah.
And so we can't impact the federal portion, although
right,
that's a much smaller portion,
okay,
looking at the data that Craig shared today.
Okay.
But I do believe that the state portion is larger, and we should have a discussion regarding that and perhaps bring legislation.
Okay, good. Thank you. See? We solved the problem.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify before the committee. We really appreciate it. We know you have full agenda coming up, and we really think that the federally qualified health centers provide a solution, not the entire solution, and appreciate some time to talk about.
Good.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And I'll have to say, since I worked for a federally qualified health center before I became a legislator, and it was actually with Clackamas County Public Health Department, and when I started working with them in 1988, they were not, and then they became one sometime in the 90s, and that transition into becoming one, we had to go through an extensive amount of work to, and so the accreditation process is very extensive, and I think we should be proud of our federally qualified health centers and encourage as many more to if possible, be formed in those communities of need.
And Senator Moniz Anderson, to follow up on that, that Oregon has really received a higher rate. I wouldn't admit this nationally than what other states have received, even though we have a smaller population. Over 3 million people. Typically, what we've seen across the country is there's been about 120 new access points or new sites or satellite sites that have been awarded each year, 120 to 130. So if you look at it, we've got 20 over a 3-year period. So we're doing quite well. So I push it to, you know, the local community is really doing a bang up job. But again, it's the viability and ongoing stability of these clinics that we're working on now.
Well, except that the local communities qualify because they have the demographics. You know, Springfield qualifies. Yeah.
Right.
Now, that's the good news. The bad news is that we qualify. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Good. Okay. Are you...
Mr. Chairman, I'm done. I'm just on for the ride, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Oh, I thought you were going to kind of...
I was the button pusher. And I want to thank the committee and Chair Morissette again for the opportunity to testify today. Thank you.
Now, that gentleman sitting right back there, did you have anything to say? Would you like to come up and say something? You kept... Your body language was saying, I...
For the record, my name is Gil Munoz, Executive Director for Virginia Garcia Memorial Health Center. We're an FQHC that provides care to about 17,000 patients currently in Washington and Yamhill counties. I'd like to just reaffirm the point about the prompt payment on the wraparound for FQHCs, particularly for new starts and for FQHCs that have opened new sites, which is our case in the last 2 years. We've opened a site in Hillsborough, in Beaverton, an expansion site in McMinnville. The wraparound payments being 9 months to a year behind create a situation of cash flow where you're dealing with current costs that are the wraparound payments are not reflective of those current costs. So that creates a considerable cash flow issue for new health centers that creates a really point of on the edge of the margin, keeping them going.
Good. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. There are a number of other people out here who are associated with the group. Would you, anyone else, like to say something? Except Mary Beth. I don't want to get her started. No, Mary Beth. Anyway, thank you very much. And I will work with Ruby on a bill draft, and we will see if we can change the payment system, the wraparound.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's it. Okay, we will close the committee.